All right. Good evening, everybody. Nice to have you all here. We are beginning Shiur number 12 of the Making of Modern Judaism, and the individual who will be discussing today is Rav Shmuel Eliezer ben Yehuda HaLevi, fondly known as the Maharsha. The Maharsha is born in Krakow, but very, very quickly, his family moves to Posen, which is the more populous Jewish community at the time. And he is, in all the institutions that he studies, he's clearly marked as an exceptional scholar right from the beginning. Because of that, interestingly enough, it's recorded that he had numerous offers of shiduchim because of his exceptional quality. And he waited, he bided his time, and ultimately marries into an extraordinarily distinguished and wealthy family. So much so that who is the real wealthy person in his family? Not his wife's father, but his mother-in-law. A woman named Adel, and for 20 years she supports him in opening a yeshiva in Posen. So for 20 years he runs this yeshiva quite successfully. And when she passes away, he takes on her name as his last name. So he becomes Rabbi Shmuel Adel's, hence the name Maharsha. Could be Rabbi Shmuel Eliezer. But he's forever known by Shmuel Adels because of her support for his scholarship. Interestingly enough, during his time from 1585 to 1605, when he's running the yeshiva in Posen, he also gets caught up in 1595 in the Maharam Milublin controversy. He has strong relationships with the Maharam. Which is fascinating on a number of levels, most of all because if you ever look in the back of the Gemara, the Maharam and the Maharsha are on the same page. And they were both very much involved in understanding and comprehending Tosfos, so it's very sensible that the two of them would be very much related. He took the side of Maharam Lublin. If you remember the whole controversy over the young man who was dying and he was forced into writing a get, and then when he was cured, he was fleeced for all of his money, etc., etc. And the Maram took up his case, and the Maram was punished for it. The Rav Yehoshua Falk Katz, the author of the Prisha and of the Sma, so he was very much on the opposite side of the Maram Milublin. And on the other side, was the Maharsha, who was a much younger scholar, and didn't necessarily have the same type of force, etc. What's interesting, what we'll see about the Maharsha, is he grows up in very much a different society than a lot of the scholars that we've been talking about recently. Why? Because they're growing up in a very new and non-established society in Poland, and they're very much kind of the Washingtons, the Jeffersons, and the Franklins, lahavdil, of the Polish Jewish community in terms of setting up the institutions. The Maharsha, however, is growing up in a community that's already established, being of the younger and second generation towards the end of the 1500s. Already he is growing up in a society that is far more established, very, very wealthy, and doing things very much correctly. And so he is the Rosh Yeshiva for about 20 years in Posen, where after his mother-in-law dies and he no longer has the funding for the yeshiva, he leaves the world of the yeshiva business and goes into the far more lucrative world of community rabbinics. And he gets a job in all places, Chelm. That's where he gets the job, which, believe it or not, was a real place. And no one would ever call the Maharsha stupid or non-educated. So I don't know if the name of the place actually lives up to all of the stories. But nonetheless, he establishes what becomes a very significant and important career there. There's a number of stories that are related. Whether they're apocryphal or not, who knows, but you know, they don't tell stories like that about you or me, about the praise that the Maharsha received from numerous Rabbanim throughout Poland, who would talk Rabbi Shmuel Edel's up from today until tomorrow about his significance and his power. In terms of where his name can be found, so remember, there's some major documentation of the Council of the Four Lands, right? This lay and rabbinic leadership group in Poland, this, you know, very powerful organization that was basically the governing body for the Jews of Poland, and for Russia, and for Ukraine, and for Lithuania, at least for parts of the time for Lithuania. But the Council of the Four Lands, so where do you find Rabbi Shmuel Edel's name? Of all documents that you would find him on, you actually find him on a document which prohibits rabbis from investing in their rabbinic position. Right. Remember, the rabbinic position in those days is lucrative. It's almost like a government position. It's secure. It has a lot of positives in terms of power and influence, etc. But you had to be voted into office by your community. That's the way you got the job. It may have been a job that you got for a good portion of your life, but nonetheless, you had to be voted in. So there were people who would invest. You know, it's a worthwhile. I could take my money, grease the right palms in terms of getting into the job. So that would be a worthwhile investment in your career, you know, to put up the money in order to become the rabbi of a town. So the Council of the Four Lands made a rule that rabbis could not pay money in order to become the rabbi of the town. That was prohibited from doing by dictum of the Council of the Four Lands. And one of the signatories on this dictum by the Council of the Four Lands was none other than Rabbi Shmuel Edels himself. For about 9 years, he is the rabbi of Chelm, before he moves on to the much more significant community of Lublin. We already spoke numerous times about how significant Lublin was, which is interesting considering on which side of the Maharam controversy that he was on the Maharam side. So when the Maharam passes away, who takes over for him but none other than one of his great allies, the Maharsha. My hunch is that there was some sort of relationship, not that he hadn't earned it. Like I said, we're going to see when we start to discuss a little bit of his scholarship, he was someone who very much earned his reputation as one of the great leaders and scholars in the Jewish community in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. And finally, he spends his last days. You can see he dies in 1631 in Ostrog. He goes there in 1625 to become the rabbi of a smaller community. It seems like more of a retirement position, but also an opportunity for him to open up or to reopen a yeshiva. So at the end of his life, what he does is he reopens the yeshiva, and for 5 years he stands at the head of the yeshiva, which ultimately carries his name after he passes away in 1631. So in terms of his political actions, the Maharam of Lublin, when we did him, and others, the Lavush, when we learned about him, they were people who were highly politically involved in a lot of the great controversies within the Jewish community. The Maharsha is not involved in almost anything. You'd be hard-pressed to find any type of controversy, any type of major issue other than the rabbinic appointment issue where the Maharsha was involved. For the most part, the Maharsha spent his time being Kosleha Yeshiva. For the most part, he spent his time not answering questions like his friend the Maharam of Lublin. The Maharam of Lublin is going to be, if you remember from when we discussed the Maharam of Lublin, so he was actively soliciting questions. He wanted people to come to him with questions because he felt like he had a lot to offer in terms of the realm of practical and pragmatic psak. The Maharsha, however, is very much, you know, living, I wouldn't say in the ivory tower of the yeshiva, but certainly very comfortably in the world of the Beis Medrash, and he is not, unless asked or sought out, he's not overly involved in a lot of the controversies and political machinations of the time within Poland. That's one of the interesting things about him. And he gains respect and admiration. And like I said, he's someone who very much till only a few years ago, and still in other circumstances, was very much considered a leader and a major scholar of the Achronim in terms of his interpretation of Gemara. So here in terms of the section on scholarship and leadership, I would say he was world-renowned for his scholarship. Really, everybody in every place knew of the Marsha. And part of this was because he was a proponent of Pilpul. We haven't really spoken about Pilpul so much, but this was the dominant mode of learning amongst the elite during the time, during the 16th century in Poland. There's a bit of debate over who actually is the founder of Pilpul. We'll just say it went around. And there were a lot of people doing it. So what is Pilpul? You'd be hard-pressed to find a stated definition of it. Think about it like today. Since probably the mid-19th century, maybe even a little bit earlier than that, there's a methodology of learning known as the Brisker Derech, which has dominated the yeshivos. So what is the Brisker Derech? So there's a bit of debate on this, but overall, one would argue it is the conceptual interpretation, right? Anytime you see an interpretation, an argument in the Gemara or in the Rishonim of practical halacha, you say that behind these opinions exists what? Exists a very, very clear conceptual definition. For example, just to give you an example, we'll do the Brisker Derech in more detail as we get into the 18th and the 19th centuries, but to give you an example, you take the classic example Rav Zevin brings in his Ishim Vishitos, the example of how do you burn chametz? Are you required to specifically burn it, or can you destroy it in any way, shape, or form? Burning is just ideal. And so Reb Chaim of Brisk, hence the name the Brisker Derech, explained it as follows. He says, what's our desire? Is our desire, is it a mitzvah that is focused on the chefza, on the object that you need to destroy? Or is it a requirement that is imposed upon the gavra, the individual who's doing it? Practical difference is, if you hold that it's based in the chefza, in the object, that our responsibility is to the object, so then the object will only be guaranteed to be destroyed if you burn it. So therefore, you're required to dafka burn it. If, however, it's focused on the human being's action, on the gavra, so then any way he gets rid of it is fine. So the Brisker Derech is basically putting in practical conceptual categories in terms of defining differences in opinion. Okay. Reb Chaim gets all the credit, but it was being done beforehand by the Minchas Chinuch, by the Ksos HaChoshen, by others. Okay, but again, there's a time and place for that. Here we're going to be discussing Pilpul. What is Pilpul? Pilpul is basically a series of assumptions. This is a very, very basic definition of it. It is a series of assumptions. Assumption 1, built upon assumption 2, built upon assumption 3. Every one of those assumptions is highly debatable. But if you build enough assumptions along, you will create a conclusion. Many, many poskim and Talmidei Chachamim of the time thought that Pilpul was pointless, to the point where they said it was prohibited, students should be discouraged from using it, etc., etc., etc. These were the criticism of it. Even the proponents of it were oftentimes saying, this is great, wonderful to do when you're sitting ben kosle a yeshiva. You know, inside the walls of yeshiva, do pilpul all you want because it sharpens your mind and gives you a keener understanding of things. However, in terms of practical discussion or conclusion in terms of halacha, in terms of how you're going to paskin. So here they said you could not use pilpul, that was the Maharam Lublin's line, you could not use pilpul in terms of paskining shilas, in terms of deciding what the practical halacha could be, again, because too many of the assumptions were tentative. For example, you would take four or five gemaras which were loosely or partially related to a given subject, claim that there were assumptions, build assumption A upon assumption B, assumption C, assumption D, assumption E, right, all of which were tentative interpretations that created these assumptions in order to come to your conclusion. So it demanded an immense amount of broad knowledge. It demanded a keen interpretive mind. It probably made for very, very interesting shiurim, but it wasn't always the best situation for deciding halacha. One of the proponents of the Pilpul methodology was the Maharsha himself. Again, because he wasn't necessarily as involved in psak halacha as other rabbanim of the time, so he can afford to be very much, you know, immersed in the world of Pilpul. And in terms of who it was that was involved in the world of Pilpul, the Maharsha was it. Which is kind of interesting, and this is why I pointed out. There was a time when the declaration, I shouldn't say there was a time, there was a good 300 years when the declaration in yeshivos was learning Tosvos without the Maharsha was like studying a body without noticing the neshama. It was like a goof without a neshama. That's what they say. When they published a Vilna Shas, who else are you going to put in the back of the Gemara if not the Maharsha's Chidushei Halachos, which is kind of an odd name to give your text, but what else are you going to call it if not Chidushei Halachos? But you won't find you'd be hard pressed to find a halacha there. What does the Maharsha do? The Maharsha is going to pick up on the Pilpul style assumptions that Tosfos is making in terms of their commentary on Shas. Okay, so he's going to be looking. What's Tosfos' questions? What's the assumption? He's going to be building buildings off of Tosfos' questions. And for generations, this is the dominant modality of learning in the yeshivos. Why is this fascinating? Because it used to be that you would learn Gemara Rashi Tosfos, you know, Rif, Rush, Ran, Maharsha. That's what you would do when you were learning Tosfos. How could you learn Tosfos without the Maharsha? I'll tell you, I was in, you know, non-mainstream and mainstream yeshivos for a while. You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who would quote a Maharsha today unless he happens to say something which you wanted to say already, and then you can, you know, you could hook it on the Maharsha. But for generations, the Maharsha was dominant. Generations, he's dominant. The Brisker Derech killed the Maharsha. Why did the Brisker Derech kill the Maharsha? The Brisker Derech is saying, instead of asking, you know, how is Tosfos, you know, reading this Gemara, assumption, The Brisker Derech is going to ask, well, what's the basis? What's behind Tosfos' statement? It's going to be asking totally different questions to the point where the Maharsha's very Pilpul style questions all of a sudden disappeared, became less relevant to the way people were learning. So it's kind of an interesting thing that happened, that for generations you have here the biggest genius who dominated the realm of Torah, who's kind of dissipating into the distance because of the way we have learned have changed. Another interesting about him is he kind of has a critical spirit. He was someone who was not ashamed of the fact that he studied philosophy. Remember, this is what one article I read called the reemergence of the Maimonidean controversy. We saw when we discussed Rav Moshe Isserles and the Maharshal that there was already a controversy about 70, 80 years earlier over the fact that the Rama was studying the Mor Nevuchim, was studying Maimonidean philosophy and Aristotle to go along with it. So this was a controversy that was bubbling under the surface in Poland over whether one could, should, or would study philosophy. The Maharsha was someone who was studying philosophy, and he's someone who has what some of the articles that I read called a critical spirit in terms of some of his understanding and interpretations of Torah. What's an example? So number one is Rav Yonasan ben Uziel. If you ever looked in some of the Mikros Gedolos, some of the more in-depth type of Chumashim that you'll see, there's an interpretation, an Aramaic interpretation called Yonasan ben Uziel. Yonasan ben Uziel, the real Yonasan ben Uziel, was a Tana, a Mishnaic interpreter from the Second Temple period. That's who Rav Yonasan ben Uziel is. The Gemara in Sukkah says that Rav Yonasan ben Uziel, when he would learn, a bird that was flying over his head would burn up in fire because there is this direct connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which we'll deal with some of those midrashim and how the Maharsha deals with them in general, but we'll get there shortly. So the Maharsha writes of Rav Yonasan ben Uziel's interpretation. He says he believes that it was a later authorship and not authored by Rav Yonasan ben Uziel. Which, again, this is a bold claim today, as it was certainly in the 1500s when the Maharsha made the claim originally. So too, the Maharsha, after reading Tosfos and Rashi on Maseches Yuma, comes to the conclusion that this is a different edited text than others. We said already that he was a close reader of both Rashi and Tosfos. Remember, he's going to be looking for every line and every, you know, dot and every assumption that's behind every letter, word, etc. in Tosfos in order to perform pilpul. So the Maharsha is reading into those Tosfos and saying that it seems to have a different style and movement and interpretive method than some of the other Tosfos he read. And again, it's implying two things. Number one is that he was a very sensitive reader of Tosfos, which we already established. Again, you know, you can't become a master of pilpul unless you're a master of how each line in Tosfos kind of changes, etc. But so too, it also implies that he had, again, what we would call a critical spirit in terms of his discussion there, and that's how he came to the conclusion that there was a stylistic difference between between Tosfos on Yuma and every other Tosfos. He was, as we said, a proponent of philosophical study. And that very much led to his commentary on the Agadah, which was probably, I guess, in terms of what is still studied, probably one of his most influential works that he wrote. And we'll discuss a little bit why. And some of his interpretations are gosh darn fascinating. To this day, his creativity and his interpretive creativity and his literary sensitivity to reading Agadah is something which has really lasted a long time. So, first of all, why is the commentary on Agadah becoming so big? So, if you see, in 1552, 3 years before the Maharsha is born, the first edition of the Ein Yaakov is finally completed by an individual by the name of Rav Levi ibn Chaviv. Rav Levi ibn Chaviv is a refugee from Spain, who ends up in North Africa as well as other places, who makes it his life job and his life's work to collect all of the non-halachic sections of the Talmud, put them together into one work he calls the Ein Yaakov. It's kind of like a reverse riff. If you remember the riff of Yitzhak Alfasi, what he does is he removes all the shaklavataria, the back and forth, and all of the stories in the Talmud, separates those and only brings down the psak halacha in the Talmud. And that's how the Rif takes positions on various items. So what does he do? He takes all the stuff that has nothing to do with halacha, puts them in a book, and he calls it the Ein Yaakov, okay, where he collects it. Many believe that his goal in doing this, and he says it a little bit in his introduction to the work, and he wrote a bit of a commentary on it also called Hakosev, the author, meaning I'm the one who put this book together. So what Rav Levi ibn Chaviv says, he's doing this to show that the Talmud weighs in on philosophical issues, that we are not just a halachic religion, but we are a religion that has a clear philosophy. And again, the Rav Levi ibn Chaviv is using this text as a way of weighing in on the Maimonidean controversy, the re-emerging Maimonidean controversy over the learning of philosophy and the study of philosophy by Jews. So the Maharsha, who is someone who has a philosophical bent to him, who's someone who is interpreting things philosophically, what do you think he's going to do when he grows up with a copy of the Ein Yaakov? He writes the very bold Sefer, a Sefer which is only comparable, again, to someone who it seems like had a good deal of influence upon the Maharsha, or the Maharal, right? The Maharal, it seems, has, you know, the Maharsha is reading in. The Maharal, like I said when we discussed the Maharal, you always get a feeling when the Maharal's interpreting an Agadah, he's not really learning the Agadah, he's learning himself. He just needed some sort of starting off point in order to do it. With the Maharsha, what you get a sense as soon as you start reading it is an immense sensitivity to the text. One reason scholars believe that this happens, that this is his magnum opus, and this is really the text which was really the defining characteristic of who he was number one is you'll find social criticism in it, and we'll do some of that. You'll find statements about philosophy, and perhaps one of the place where he was most creative was in his ability to pick out on allegory within these Talmudic texts. So we all know that there are fantastical stories and non-fantastical stories in the Talmud, and the Maharsha takes it upon himself to understand each and every one of these. And Baruch Hashem, for all of us, it's been brought down. In all the new editions of the Ein Yaakov since the Maharsha, the Maharsha's commentary is published alongside the text of the Talmud. That's how significant his interpretation is. And if you've ever seen in Ein Yaakov, you can see the Maharsha is there. So let's just start. I brought for you three quotes here from the Maharsha's interpretation of Agadah. So number one is from his introduction to it. And he starts, it's a very short introduction as far as 16th century introductions go. One of the ways I prepare this year is you get to know everything about every rabbi in their introductions. So one thing you know is that everyone enjoys a good introduction, because there'll be an introduction by the author, by the child of the author, by the editor, the publisher. Everyone needs to get in their introduction, and everyone needs to write a poem. Baruch Hashem, that Hebrew is easy to rhyme, so everyone's got to start with a poem. The Maharsha is very terse and to the point in terms of his introduction. He says, these are my goals. In terms of what I'm trying to do here. Number one is, he says, people haven't been learning Agadot, people haven't been learning the more story-based parts of the Gemara. I'm going to be bringing a book here that will allow you to study story-based parts of the Gemara, etc., etc. But let me first tell you, let me take shots at people who I think have been doing it wrong for generations. So who are those people? So here he starts to go, amar ein motzo min ha-mikra. So he says, any statement which is not, so he differentiates between different types of agadot. A lot of agadot are trying to interpret the text. He says, but if you have something that's not interpreting the text, imu ma'ase zar v'nifla, if you have a strange and wondrous depiction here, or something which defies logic, human logic, he says, I'm going to interpret those as what? As parables. I'm going to interpret it. Umlitza. He says, this is one of the main needs, or the gap in scholarship that I am feeling is going to these texts which people have misinterpreted throughout generations. I'm going to interpret them allegorically as a parable rather than as pshat. He says, "Mitol shekatzru Chazal divrayim." The rabbi spoke in very brief language. Hey, nirim kistumim. They look like they are, impossible to understand. V'yesh lanu ledaktik b'divrei chachamim v'chidotam. He says, "What do we need to do? We need to infer from the words of the rabbis and their riddles." B'chol advarim shamarnu. And everyone who has a brain in their head, he says, should be able to add and to interpret as they go along. So he says, but what happens? He says, but many people who study these non-halachic portions of the Talmud, they're not careful here. B'divrei Chazal. They're not seeking to understand each thing according to its truth. What are they doing? He says they're trying to spew what they're saying to, call out their words from the rooftops, and here's a quote from Kohelet, like the crackle or the noise of under a pot, which is meaningless, because what you want to see is what's in the pot. That's what he says. The Yesh Mehem Shabbat Lidrosh al Agadot Shel Dofi. They start to understand or to interpret agadot that are false, ukaosim toratam plaster, and they make these false kind of images of agadot she'ena mikra v'amapar sofel drushim. He says that basically the real text won't suffer these interpretations. Aval he midamin surah li yotzra. they mold the Agada into what they think it should mean. V'chachamim heim beinim la'asig maleni menu dvarim sheim kivshono shel olam. V'aleim shaninu reish parak ein dorshim kol shelo chas al kvod kono ra'uy lo shelo nivra. He says, and about these people who think to twist and turn the Agadot into their own interpretations, he says, about them it says, anyone who doesn't care for the honor of his maker, better that he was never born. Okay, so the Maharsha is a bit obviously he's being polemical here, but he's clearly unhappy with the historical interpretations of the Talmud. Interestingly enough, is one of his inspirations. The Maharal was someone who may have been twisting Agadot. Clearly, he shared the Maharsha's desire to read things allegorically, but he was known for twisting Agadot to fit his own philosophy. All right, fine. So let's just give some things here. So some just a little bit of his social commentary here. Chidushi Agadot in Ketubot Daf Samach Zayin Amud Aleph. He says V'rabim b'dor hazeh shemekapsim osher shelahem. He's talking about a particular criticism that the Gemara has of people who are hoarding wealth. And he says, many people in our current generation, what do? They collect their wealth, shelo be'emunah, dishonestly, uvechilul Hashem, and publicly desecrating God's name, kegzeilat uveit kochavim, because they think it's okay to steal from non-Jews. So they steal from non-Jews. And he says, v'achar kach miznadvi me'oso mamon li'os lahem kavod. He says, what do they do afterwards? They collect all this money. Right? They collect all this money by being dishonest in terms of their dealings with non-Jews. And what do they do with their money afterwards? They give it over to the local yeshiva. So this way, they get, you know, all this honor and this kavod. That's what he says. I know you can't imagine anybody doing such a thing, but, you know, in those days, those things used to happen, apparently. Right? B'chol shana v'latit lahem birachat mishaberach. And they do it, why? So they get a nice mishaberach. In shul, lios lahem shem v'sifares, in order that they should have a name and honor, and glory, excuse me. Ve'ein ze ela mitzvah ba'aveira. He says this is a mitzvah that comes about through a sin. Ve'ein l'osha ze melech v'kiyum kedam arhacha. And this type of wealth, he says, will not last and will not be eternal, as it says in this Gemara. So here you see a bit of social commentary. You know, to a certain extent, as they say, plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. The more things change, the more they change, stay the same. But just an interesting kind of social commentary that you have here in the Marsha. Basically, I assume that his interpretation of the text was sound, but he uses that interpretation to take a shot at what he's believed as some of the dishonest business practices of the people of his time, and the use of those dishonest practices in order to gain yourself honor within the Jewish community. Another interesting case is the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph. You remember the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, which I'm sure you all remember, is where the ger, the convert, the potential convert, comes to both Shammai and Hillel, asking him, "Convert me while I'm standing on one. If you on the condition that you teach me Torah while I'm standing on one foot." So Shammai, what does he use to kick the guy out? Shammai, the Gemara says, uses amat habinyan shebiyado, a measuring tool that you use for measuring the building of some sort of building. Like, it's like kind of an architect's or a builder's tool. Which, you know, most people read past that, and they don't think twice about it, you know, because, you know, what do I, he was holding his building, I don't know what he was doing. So the Marsha says, the Gemara, it's not just whistling Dixie, right? The Gemara is not just giving you details for the sake of giving you details, but every detail that's going to be in this Gemara is going to be meaningful. And then he wants to know, how does that relate to what Beis Hillel later says to him? Beis Hillel, what does he say? The guy stands on one foot. Beis Hillel says, what you hate, don't do to other people's. That's kolatura kula. Everything else is perusha. Everything else is commentary. Now go learn, right? So what's going on here, and what's the whole standing on one foot thing? So here, the Marsha, again, insightful, interpretive method, allegorical, interpretive, great. It's one of the most beautiful Marshas you'll read. But if I told you every one of his comments on the Agadah is like this, I don't know if you would believe me, but it really is. Almost everything he says is this insightful. So the Marsha says as follows. Mirhe de shigamu nitkavin latriya tshuva de hillel de hainu shiliyam deinu shakola Torah tiela regel v'yesod echad. He says, what's the guy asking when he asks, they teach me all of it on one foot? He's saying, I want all of the Torah to be taught from one perspective, on one level. That the entire of the Torah is ethical commitment. He says, how do I know that? I know that from Hillel. I want to know that the entire Torah is only Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. That's what I want to say. Right? V'amar shedachav Shammai ba'amas ha'binyan. Right? And what does Shammai do? Shammai kicks him, chases him out of there with what? With this measuring tool for building. Right? U'le'el lo omar ashigaru b'nizifa. V'hainu mishum dahacha ramazlo. What's Shammai telling him when he kicks him out with the amas ha'binyan, with the building tool? Dahacha ramazlo kemosha ha'binyan yivyesher shalo lamo b'yisod echad. Right? Just as, what does he say? Just as the building can't stand with just one base, right? You need a broad base for the building. Kach kein haTorah rechava b'mitzvoseh, right? So too the Torah is broad in terms of its base. Efshar la'litein yisod echad, right? You can't give it merely one pillar. You can't say there's one thing, there's one leg on which Torah stands. It doesn't work. It's a building. It needs a broader base in order to stand on. V'chein ra mazlo l'kamam ba'amas ha'binyan gam ima amanashi yasuni koin gal de'ein Torah medes al yisun kuhuna bilvad. Says that's a later on. Right? What does Beis Hillel say? Beis Hillel, on the other hand, says, no, it can be done that way. You just have to view the Bein Adam L'Makom, he says, you have to view the stuff between man and God, you have to view those as what? As the interpretation, or basically the motivation, I would call it, for treating your friends properly. Right? That your relationship with God, ultimately your davening, your learning, your sedra, should make you a better person. Right? You're right. Being a good person is the first step. That's the primary goal of Judaism. We believe, though, you can't reach that goal without having all the other religious and spiritual inspirations that go along with it. So again, here you have kind of simple details, you know, like the use of the Amat HaBinyan, which, you know, most people overlook and kind of just like, all right, he uses the Amat HaBinyan for the Marsha, becomes kind of essential information. This is how he learned all of the Gemara, and which is why, you know, all those fantastical stories that are all over the Gemara, that too often people, you know, the Rambam says people interpreted incorrectly by assuming that the rabbis were, you know, were crazy or insane or you know, non-illogical and irrational people. Marsha is saying that no, they were writing in a philosophical style of allegory, again, returning and rebuilding the Rambam's perspective in kind of this new and very creative and innovative way, which I said, I think, in terms of all of his texts, in terms of the lasting power of this text, you'll still hear Marsha. You know, if you ever come across one of those texts, you go to the back of your Gemara, and there's the Marsha, and oftentimes his interpretations are immensely insightful and really bring a lot to the interpretation that can be offered in there. And so, that, in a nutshell, is Rabbi Shmuel Eliezer ben Yehuda Alevi Edels. Edels, after his great mother-in-law, who launched him upon his brilliant career in scholarship, an individual who had, we saw, a real strong moral center, someone who was creative in his thought, and for generations, I said, his method of learning Tosfos was the dominant one within the yeshiva world, and certainly his methodology in terms of Haggadah created kind of a new methodology of interpretation, or I should say, reconstituted an old methodology and perhaps perfected an allegorical reading of the Talmud, which I think is a methodology that continues to grow today. And I think as generations go on, and the more we see allegory, the more we realize the brilliance and how much the Maharsha was really ahead of his time. All right, questions, comments.
Just in general, how do these Rabbanim in those days, obviously there's no internet, there's no nothing, how do they get out there like and get the prestige that they you know what I'm saying? How does the word get? It takes months and months?
Yeah, it takes months, years. Why you Torah? You know, no, they would write, and, you know, there was a printing press, and as soon as the new book came out, you know, everyone would go out and run and read it, and, you know, you got a good book review, and everyone would start reading it, and that's the way it worked.
It was Gutenberg, 14...
Yeah, no, remember, all this, the Shulchan Aruch is post... Gutenberg's much earlier. Remember, all you have probably the fame of these Rabbanim specifically because of their ability to write and to publish. Yeah.
And
yeah.
People like Rashi and Rambam were widely known even when they were alive.
Right. So, but you also
only in their communities.
You know, you'd be right. So it was like Yechidei Skula who were like this, and things would travel by word of mouth also. And, you know, so you would have, you know, one or two or three, you know, publishers, but it was pretty much in the same way also. You just have a lot of scribes spending a lot of time writing things. You're just part of the...
Taking it out to different places.
Yeah, you know, you would write a tshuva, and the tshuva would sit in the shul, and, you know, everyone would learn from that tshuva.
Last time I was at the Shrine of the Book, I remember seeing... a Chumash with Rashi, published in Russia, something like 30 years after Rashi died.
Yeah, no, Rashi...
Way across your
head. Rashi took over the world almost instantaneously.
So he's the exception.
No, I'm saying there are people who I think you would call Yachid Bedoram, you know, like individuals who are unique in their generations. Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, the Rambam, the Ramban. In I would say in Hebrew literature and poetry, Rav Yehuda Halevi, people who are so exceptionally good at what they do that their reputation spread immensely quickly, that people are willing to spend large sums of money for copies of their texts. So yeah, so Rashi, that's what annoyed Ibn Ezra to no end, was that Rashi undermined traditional Sephardic interpretation. In a few years, basically everything Rav Saadia Gaon tried to build, you know, 150, 200 years beforehand, was wiped out by Rashi in a moment because everyone in Sfarad is starting to read Rashi. So he writes Ibn Ezra in order to defend the old style, you know, Pshat interpretations of the Sephardic tradition. That's Marty Lakshin's interpretation, not my own. So Rashi takes over. Ibn Ezra is almost responding to everything there. So,
and speaking of Rambam, I didn't know there was ever a time when people didn't really read him and study him.
No, they always studied him. The
so
question is:
so what's the source of this controversy?
The controversy is over whether philosophy is a worthwhile endeavor for the Jewish student.
So there. I mean, that's a big part of Rambam's work.
Correct, but I mean, no, it's not a big part of Rambam's work. I could study 90% of the Mishneh Torah and never know that there's any philosophy, that the Rambam ever learned philosophy. Like, never hear of Aristotle, never hear of anything. If I pick up a Moreh Nevuchim, what the Maharshal got upset at the Rama for... was that the Rama was quoting the Moreh Nevuchim, which was quoting Aristotle. And what the Rama says to Maharshal is, Zuhi machloket yishana. This is an old and ancient controversy. You know, we've been arguing about this for generations, and the truth is, they start arguing about it, you know, in the 1200s. And it kind of reemerges in, like, because, again, you have this burgeoning community in Poland. You know, so all the issues that have been rehashed over time, you have this, you know, merging of Ashkenazi communities from all over, it would make sense that these different educational philosophies coming together would create kind of a clash of societies. Right. Hold on.